1 week from today, George W. Bush takes the oath of office for a second time. He'll be just the 16th president to enjoy a second inaugural, but for every chief executive, the inaugural address provides a rare opportunity to speak to the American people, to the world, and to history.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I do not believe that the great society is the ordered, changeless, and sterile battalion of the ants. It is the excitement of becoming, always becoming, trying, probing, falling, resting, and trying again, but always trying and always gaining.
Government must learn to take less from people so that people can do more for themselves.
A settler pushes west and sings a song, and the song echoes out forever and fills the unknowing air. It is the American sound. It is hopeful, big-hearted, idealistic, daring, decent, and fair. That's our heritage. That's our song. We sing it still.
From this joyful mountaintop of celebration, we hear a call to service in the valley. We have heard the trumpets. We have changed the guard. And now, each in our own way, and with God's help, we must answer the call. Thank you, and God bless you all.
President Bush's second inaugural address promises to be quite different in tone and content from his first, delivered while the nation was just beginning to recover from the election debacle in Florida. After his decisive victory this past November, the president said he won political capital. Next Thursday, we may begin to hear how he hopes to spend it. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, the president said he expects to focus on a couple of broad themes: freedom abroad and what he calls the ownership society here at home. Will the president use his mandate to stake out bold but controversial policies or look to heal the bitter divisions of the campaign? Later in the program, the discovery of two new species of lemur in the wilds of Madagascar. But first, a look ahead at President Bush's second inaugural address. We'll also talk with the author of a book on John F. Kennedy's indelible speech. What do recent events and history tell you to expect next Thursday? Do you hope to hear "Come Together" or "Follow Me"? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now are two men who know a little bit about striking the right rhetorical note. Peter Robinson is a former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and for the first President Bush. He's the author of the book, How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. Peter Robinson joins us from the studio at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Nice to have you back on the program.
Neil, a pleasure. Thank you.
Also with us here in Studio 3A is Paul Glastris, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and now editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine. And always nice to have you on the program, Paul.
Great to be here.
Now, we've talked to you both in the past about crafting State of the Union messages. Peter, why don't we begin with you? An inaugural address is considerably different.
It is indeed. There's a tremendous temptation for a speechwriter to sit and hear in his mind's ear, so to speak, those clips that you just played, John Kennedy, FDR. Then what the speech, if the speechwriter's like me, you'll go to the book of speech, you'll flip through and look at actual inaugural addresses and realize with a terrible thud that most inaugural addresses are just terrible. They reach too high, they try too hard, and say too little. That's what you have to avoid. And you also, in my judgment, the fellows who are working for Bush right now, they can't permit themselves in their minds to hit their man up against JFK or FDR or Ronald Reagan, people who were naturally gifted with wonderful, embracing voices, With Bush, you've got to be achieve a quite a different key or register or tone. He did it, I think, very successfully in the first inaugural. You have to be straightforward, and you have to rely on the strength of your message. Don't reach. Don't let a sense of strain enter into the speech.
And Paul Glastris, you've talked about this, too. To find the speechwriter needs to find the president's voice.
That's right, and Peter's right. If you listen to those clips, there's only a couple of them I'm sure they pulled the best that they could from Johnson and Reagan and Clinton, and I don't remember any of those passages. I do remember, of course, we all remember Kennedy's and FDR's and of course, Lincoln's, probably the greatest second inaugural address, or maybe the greatest inaugural address of all time. These are special speeches. They're known for their brevity and for their language that seems tailored to be chiseled into marble on presidential monuments sometime, and that is going to be the danger here.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is not the State of the Union, which tends to be a laundry list of we're going to work on this and work on that.
No, but right. if I may, if there is something that one of the reasons that these inaugural addresses tend to be so bad is that especially the second term, the presidents tend not to have anything much to say. They don't have. Their agendas aren't as expansive and bold as their first terms were, and they try to fill the air with bold statements that mean nothing. And in this case, you have a president who does have some bold things he wants to do. So there's a chance for this to be a pretty good speech, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, some big obstacles to getting there.
Yeah, and Peter Robinson, as he looks ahead, I mean, the president, again, we don't know what the words are going to be, and obviously there's disagreement about policies, but the president's policies don't lack for ambition.
No, they don't lack for ambition. That much, I think, has become clear about this man and the way he conducts himself in the presidency. He wants to think big, and so there's a little danger there for the speechwriting staff. Incidentally, one thing we should stipulate is that presidents work in different ways with their speechwriters. Lincoln, thank God, had no speechwriter. That was all his own work. But George W. Bush works very hard on his major speeches, and he works his speechwriters. Those guys are in and out of his office. They're in and out of his home down in Texas, going through draft after draft after draft. One thing we can say for certain is that whether it's a good speech or a bad speech, it'll be his. He will be fully invested in this speech by the time he delivers it.
Yeah.
By the way, there's one. So far, the best advice I could give to these poor saps who are working on this darn thing is negative. Bill Buckley told me that he once asked Whitaker Chambers what Whitaker Chambers thought of the oratory of General Douglas MacArthur, and Chambers replied, "Yard after yard of velvet." That's exactly what you want to avoid, don't you think, Paul?
Absolutely, and George Bush tends to be talk in the as we've talked about in this program before, the, mm-hmm. the sort of stratospheric level of principle and value, and if he writes straight as if he's talking to average people, that can work. If they try to be lofty and rhetorical about it, I don't think it will.
Mm-hmm. There right. is also an element of I'm not being demeaning at all in this. This is drama. This is theatrics. This is a performance. Yet it's a very restrictive stage. There's not a lot you can do up there.
You mean from the audiovisual point of view?
Exactly. I mean, you sort of remember John Kennedy boldly taking his hat off in the cold, but other than that, you know.
Right. And not only that, though, chances are extremely good that not only will the setting work against you, you know that there's no audiovisual, you can't even gesture very well because you won't be seen, but you'll be seen on television, but by the crowd in front of you, there's a good chance they'll miss you. But the weather is going to work against you, most likely. Remember Kennedy, it had heavy snowfall the night before. That day, the sun was blinding off the snow. Robert Frost, reading his poem, lost his place. He couldn't see it, what he was reading. George W. Bush, 4 years ago, I remember this, Neil, because I was on the air with you immediately after the inaugural.
That's right.
It was sloppy, foggy, wet, dreary, horrible weather. You wanted him to talk fast just so you could get out of there and go home to a warm place. It's a really hard setting from almost every point of view in which to deliver a text. So the text itself has to be strong. In my judgment, with George W. Bush, it needs to be simple and straightforward. Also, I'll add one more point. I'd like to hear what Paul has to say about this. Brevity. Reagan's second inaugural, Clinton's second inaugural, both ran to well over 2,000 words, and both were, sorry to say this, in my judgment, completely forgettable. John Kennedy, under 1,400 words. Abraham Lincoln, second, 703 words. There's a point to being short.
Yeah, not only that, I think he's facing some real uphill battles in conveying his message at a time when the big things he wants to talk about, the war in Iraq, privatizing Social Security, are you know, running into some major obstacles, and to sort of talk with great aspiration and great excitement about these things in the face of that might sound off, and conveying a sense of the challenge and the boldness of it, getting in, getting out, is probably very wise.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. You can email us, totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Mark, who's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My concerns about his speech are going to be that they're... It's going to follow along the same lines as the sort of polemical speech that he gave after 9/11. It was the first major speech. I agree with your guess that his message needs to be simple, but it shouldn't be simplistic. And I really think that, you know, it would be nice if he would step up and address the, and I know this is a somewhat overused word, especially since the election, but a more nuanced view of what is really going on in this world. And that would be a very satisfying thing if he could actually start talking about all the interactive details that we face in the next 4 years.
Peter, let me ask you briefly. We just have a few seconds left in the segment. But is an inaugural address a moment for nuance?
Typically not. Typically what you want in the inaugural address is not to teach or to lay out anything in detail, but to establish a kind of feeling of share, a communion of feeling and ideals. That's typically what you try to do. I would agree. I'll try to be very brief on this, Neil. That as regards the war in particular, the president has a special duty to explain to the American people where we stand, why we're in it, and where we intend to go. He and he alone, with a few handful of advisors, makes the key decisions in regard to that war without the usual congressional oversight. As commander-in-chief, the Constitution vests him with hugely disproportionate powers. That he alone can explain to us, and he must do something of that in the inaugural.
Mark, thanks for the call. We'll be back with more on the second inaugural address of George W. Bush after a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're talking today about inaugural addresses. President George W. Bush delivers his second 1 week from today. And our guests are Paul Glastris, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, a political magazine. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Joining us from Stanford University is Peter Robinson, a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, and George Herbert Walker Bush, the author of How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. And, of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Hank in Centennial, Colorado.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. My question, and I was wondering if your commentators could address it, is whether speeches have been skewed in the soundbite era. In other words, whether there's a deliberate attempt to make a 1-2-3-phrase bit that'll be replayed on television and radio and so forth. And I'll take my answer off the air.
And we'll try to be pithy in about 9 seconds.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Paul Glastris.
We certainly, in the Clinton White House, on would try to note where the soundbite would be because we knew the media would look for it, and we wanted to make sure that we gave them the little clip that they'd use in the evening news. But on the other hand, great sentences are great sentences, and they've been great sentences throughout history, we have nothing to fear but fear itself was a great soundbite, but it wasn't intended as such.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how the human ear hears things and how great speech givers write them.
Peter, in the soundbite, do we undervalue rhetoric?
Oh, well, I probably the three of us don't, Neil. You're a radio man and Paul and I are writers. My general feeling, though, is that the way the word rhetoric is used, oh, that's just rhetoric, or, oh, don't give me rhetoric, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Winston Churchill rhetoric. Was wet rhetoric.
Yes, exactly. Winston Churchill was rhetoric. Listen to I've got Lincoln's second inaugural. Here's a soundbite. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. What's that, about 15 seconds? That would have been a soundbite. I agree with Paul completely. Powerful, well-constructed, meaningful sentences ring in the ear and always have.
Another caller. Gary is with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, Neil. Great show.
Thanks.
At the beginning of the program, you said you wanted to know if the speech was going to be a come-together speech or a follow-me kind of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it would be or could be or should be a come-together kind of speech because even though many people in America and in the loyal opposition party, the Democratic Party, may have initially opposed going into Iraq, maybe now is the time to realize, well, we're over there. And we have to unite behind a common ideal that would lead, hopefully, to peace and freedom and democracy in that troubled part of the world.
Paul, you're from the opposition on this point of view.
I think the great speeches are always come-together speeches. Peter mentioned the second inaugural address in which the country was on the North was on the verge of winning the Civil War, and yet Lincoln was remarkably humble and talked about both sides reading from the same Bible. That's just not this president's style. He believes that he's right and his side is right. He can put out some words about working with the other side, but it's never been his style. The war was not, and the way it was prosecuted was not one that brought in a lot of other points of view. His domestic policies are not one that are crafted to appeal to a bipartisan majority. So I think you'll see some, you know, rhetoric, to misuse the word, on that. But I don't think they'll make the mistake of making that the central part of the speech, because that's just not his style.
And Peter, I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, as we said, the president has ambitious goals. Isn't this an opportunity to say, rally around me, let's go?
Well, there has to be a certain implicit rally around me, I'm the leader. Think of the setting. It's one man having the chutzpah to use a nice rhetorical word, to stand up in front of the entire nation, indeed the entire world, and lay out what he wants to say. Now, before coming on the air just now, I went through a few of the inaugural addresses. Reagan's first inaugural is better than his second. FDR's first is the best. JFK's is wonderful. All three of those have something in common, and that is that they lay out in a very clear and completely unapologetic way what it is that this new president wishes to do. It's a kind of inbuilt aspect of the moment that the man speaking must convey himself as a leader, tell us where he wants to go and how he intends to get us there. So it would be a failing of this inaugural address if Bush didn't do that. Now, of course, there are questions of tone. Every good inaugural address has to recognize that he's president of the entire country, has to attempt to knit together the country after, of course, Lincoln is the extreme case. The nation was actually at war. But every president speaks to the nation after a difficult, after an election in which something like half of the people have voted against him. So that has to be there, too. But this is, in my judgment, that's something of a false dichotomy. The clear speech, the powerful speeches, the effective speeches, are speeches given by a leader who's unapologetic about being the leader.
Hmm. Gary, thanks for the call. But I'd like to play a clip of tape of a unique inaugural. This is Gerald Ford's inaugural address. This was in 1974, after the nation still in shock following the resignation of President Nixon and the Watergate scandal.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy.
President Ford in 1974. Paul Glastris, it's interesting. Peter was just saying that at every inaugural, in a sense, the nation is in political turmoil just after a campaign. That occasion more than most, not after a campaign, but after a resignation. Yet, how does the inaugural address hope to achieve, in this case, the unachievable? Our long national nightmare was not exactly over, but go ahead.
Well, I think there's a tension between the humility and the kind of selflessness that you heard from Gerald Ford. And what you're likely to hear from George W. Bush and the sort of the powerful leader model. I think Peter's right. That's what all inaugural addresses do and need to do. But President Bush is a little bit unique, and my old boss at the White House, Michael Waubman, pointed out to me, his speeches, there's not a lot of effort to persuade. He's not trying to persuade you of his point of view. He's trying to convey the intensity of his own belief in these positions. And I believe this is what we must do. And it has some effect. I mean, the man won re-election, so it works. But it's not a reaching across to bring us all into, for all of us, even those who didn't vote for me, to feel good about where we're headed. Mm-hmm. That's just really not the aim.
Yeah, Peter, you've talked a moment ago about the importance, you think, of leadership. And you spoke earlier about that the president has an obligation to lay out his vision for Iraq. Mm. I'm going to ask you,
I do believe that.
On the domestic front, what do you think he needs to address?
Well, in that case, it's a if he talks about the ownership society, I'm not sure that I'm completely happy with that phrase. But if he comes up with some notion, something that can be described briefly, that ties what he intends to do with these large social programs, social security, education, and so forth, that roots them, his program, in the American tradition of individual responsibility, that's about what you'd hope for. And in my judgment, that's about all you could expect in an inaugural address. There are a couple of the domestic stuff, we all get a chance to weigh in on that. Congress gets to chew it over in committee after committee after committee. The distinction I draw is between domestic matters, which are slow moving and which have plenty of opportunity to be exposed and discussed and chewed over in the political process, and warfare, where the key decisions get made in the Situation Room in the Pentagon, far from reporters, far from the people. The president has a special obligation in acquitting himself as commander-in-chief to bring the public along, to inform and persuade, a special obligation in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Paul, let me ask you on that on those same things. Peter mentioned that do you agree with Peter that he needs to lay out the future for Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. And there is an opportunity here for him to be a little bit honest with the horrible position we find ourselves in and to lay out a plausible scenario whereby this could work out advantageously as advantageously can be expected. And, you know, he can make that case, and I hope he will. But he's working against public opinion here. 56% of the public thinks the war wasn't worth fighting and so forth. It's a difficult situation, and one doesn't look at the news and think there's a lot of evidence for optimism. And it's a hard position to be in.
Yeah, and Peter, he's a little bit trapped by just the dates. He's got the election in Iraq just 10 days after he speaks. You don't want to be speaking too broadly. Who knows what's going to happen then?
Well, that's true. It's a difficult position. On the other hand, it's a pretty good paying job, you know. Never any never any trouble finding people who want the job. I find it virtually impossible to work up a tear in my eye for George W. Bush at this point. What a terrific opportunity.
Absolutely.
He got us into that war. He thinks he knows what he's doing. Now he has a moment when the entire world will listen to him. And in my judgment, now, Paul and I will disagree about this, but this is one thing the president has to do. I don't think that we're in such a horrible situation, given historical standards, and that the president will be addressing the world just 10 days before there will be this amazing fact, an actual election in Iraq, however flawed, however messy. That's a tremendous thing for him to be able to talk about, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah.
But talk about it, he must. There, I think we all agree.
And he's also talked not just the election in Iraq, but a couple of weeks after the election in the Palestinian areas and just a couple of months after the election in Afghanistan. So
exactly. That's a kind of a triple crown for a president, in my judgment,
to be certainly
able to talk about three.
There's certainly great material to work with. That's for sure. And this can be quite an important speech, and maybe a great speech. We'll know, however, if it's a great speech years from now when we look back at these next 4 years and know whether Iraq worked out to the advantage of the world or not, whether the ownership society happened and worked out to the advantage of the American people or not.
Thanks to you both, as always. It's always interesting to hear speechwriters talk about their craft. Peter Robinson wrote for Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. He's the author of the book, How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. He joined us from Stanford. Thanks very much, as always.
Neil, a pleasure, and I'm going to hang on to listen to this news about the lemurs.
Okay. And Paul Glastris, he was a speechwriter for President Clinton, and he was with us here in Washington in Studio 3A, and the editor of, what's your magazine again?
TheWashingtonMonthly.com.
Also, as we've spoken, perhaps the best remembered of recent inaugural addresses is that of John F. Kennedy in 1961.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
John F. Kennedy, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The Kennedy inaugural also, of course, included the famous words, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." We heard those earlier in the program. Writer Thurston Clark recently completed a book about Kennedy's famous speech entitled, quite appropriately, "Ask Not, the Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America." And he's with us now from a studio at Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Many regard John Kennedy's speech as the right speech at the right time. How come?
Well, I think that the Americans in 1961 were already longing for Kennedy's words. There was a feeling that we'd lost our national purpose, that the country had no role anymore. You had the Sputnik 3 years before. You'd had a lot of setbacks in the Cold War, and people were really looking towards Kennedy. They wanted to be roused, and I think that's very important. I think the importance of an audience has sometimes been underestimated.
And the importance of the audience, you said, you've also said that this was a sort of a passage through a membrane.
Yes. I think that one of the most important influences that Kennedy's speech has had is that it set many lives on courses that they're still following today. James Meredith, for example, wrote to the University of Mississippi asking for an application the night after hearing Kennedy's speech. The cardinal, who became Pope Paul VI, was so moved by the speech that he says that he kept listening to it again and again and rereading it. And you can hear it echoed in his landmark 1967 encyclical. Late Congressman Robert Matsui, former HEW Secretary Donna Shalala, Kofi Annan, Richard Holbrooke, these are all people who have mentioned the inaugural address as having a profound influence on their lives. So that's why I think a lot of people walked into a new era with Kennedy, and it was an era of, some people have called it an era of public happiness, of idealism. And I think that the energy that was released by Kennedy's speech continued to be a factor in American life for decades and still is.
You called it also a call for public service, ask not. Yet John Kennedy also said, "Let every nation know whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty." Many see that as the first step down the road toward Vietnam.
Well, it's important to look at that particular passage in the context of the speech. Most of the speech was very conciliatory. He was holding out an olive branch to Khrushchev. He was saying, "Let us negotiate together." He goes on and on for most of the middle part of the speech, proposing cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union. Now, at the same time, this particular passage was meant to show Khrushchev and the world that the youngest man who had ever been elected president was not going to be pushed around by the Soviets. It's actually quite interesting that about 3 or 4 hours before he dictated that passage to Evelyn Lincoln on January 10th, he had a very important briefing from diplomat George Kennan about peace feelers from Moscow. And Kennan explained that there were two sets of feelers that he'd been getting. One was kind of hardline, and the other was from Khrushchev himself, hoping that there could be some kind of a beginning of negotiation. And so Kennedy's tried to speak to both factions in the speech, and that the line that you just quoted was to let the hardliners know that he wasn't going to be pushed around.
Thurston Clark, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Thurston Clark is the author of many books, the most recent of which is Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. He joined us from a studio at Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. When we come back from a short break, a defeat in court today for advocates of creationism in Georgia. And, of course, we'll get to that story about the lemurs being discovered, two new species of primates. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.